All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Do not attempt to adjust your dial. I'm so old school, of course I would say a dial as if it was a radio. We learned on a previous episode of Questlove Supreme, you gotta follow the light. And so we're doing something rather different. This is gonna be a one-on-one interview. And, you know, oftentimes we just have to, you know what? Okay, normally I would do my normal jargon of, you know, we have greatness in the room and da-da-da-da-da, but I feel that's a lot of pressure sometimes. So I will just simply say that this is an episode of two friends, two colleagues, having a conversation with each other. And I don't know. It's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a conversation with the one and only, how do I describe him? Andre Lauren Benjamin, aka Three Stacks. Shit, he's so enlightening. He might be Four Stacks right about now. Aka Johnny Vulture, Sonny Bridges.
I forgot about those. Yeah, just tripped out.
The nicest Gemini I know. Like, he's the exception to my no Geminis rule. Sorry about that.
come on now.
No, but you're Geminis, man. You're May Gemini, though. So, you know, I like to think you're more Taurus adjacent than June Geminis. I don't know. I don't get along with many June Geminis. So
Gemini's crazy, man. Like, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, yes, yeah, you are all, man, crazy.
But so crazy that you're just into it. Like, whatever we into, we crazy about it. Yeah.
No, you guys are bold. I mean, look, dude, our hero Prince is a Gemini.
Yeah, man.
So many Geminis out there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I want to do something a bit different because I know you're on a press run. And I know when an artist does a press run where you just do an interview after interview after interview after interview, the muscle memory kicks in. You're answering the same exact questions over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to use this as an opportunity to actually to get to know you as a human.
All right, let's stretch then.
Yeah, and so I'll say that I'm taking a 3,000 approach in Questlove Supreme land, and I'm going to throw out questions that I wouldn't typically ask on a QLS episode. And No.
This is going to get fun.
Yeah, I assure you. I assure you it's that. So my first question to you is, what time do you wake up in the morning, just automatically? Not like on the clock, I got to get to the airport, but what's your body clock? When do you wake up?
About 8 a.m. maybe, like naturally, about 8 a.m.
Naturally 8 a.m.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a morning routine? What do you do in the first half hour of your day?
Like, I've never used social media, so I've never had a Twitter account. I only have an Instagram account now to preserve my name, but I've never ever posted anything in my life. Mm-hmm. So it's funny that when I see most people in the world and they're constantly checking their Instagram, like, you know, kind of going through these little things. So when I get up in the morning, I have my TV set up to, like, I'm a YouTube person, man. Like, YouTube is my university. So I just watch a whole bunch of shorts, just random shorts. I guess the same thing someone would do scrolling through Instagram. But yeah, I kind of get thrown stuff from the YouTube alga.
Okay. Where do you live?
I live in Venice Beach. I live a few blocks up from here. I live in Venice Beach, California.
How long have you lived out in Venice?
About four or five years now, maybe.
So was there ever a time you lived in New York?
Yeah, I lived in New York for 4 years before I came here. So I lived in Atlanta, lived in Dallas for 2 years. Then I moved to New York for about 3 years, maybe, and then moved here.
I heard a crazy rumor. Are you a fishing aficionado?
No, I started going deep sea fishing. Like, my family took me deep sea fishing, and I enjoyed it. And I invited Big Boy on a couple of them, and Big Boy, like, he's been running with it. Like, Big Boy goes out and deep sea fishes all the time now. So I think you may be confusing me with Big Boy.
Well, I heard that someone told me, like, in Long Island once that you, like, I saw Andre 3000, like, going fishing in Long Island. I was like, Long Island? He's not from New York. He's like, yeah, he's from New York. So,
oh, no. No. What do young people say? That's cap.
Okay. That's a good rumor, though.
I mean, fishing is awesome. You know, I've never done it in Long Island, though.
Okay. And these are also non sequitur and random questions.
No, I love these kind of questions. Like, you're interviewing me like a
human.
Well, when we go to Europe.
Yeah.
They ask different questions.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? I like the different.
Well, I figured you're just tired of asking the same thing. Where have you been? You know. How many instruments do you play or can you play?
I can mess around with maybe four or five to get a sound out of them, but I don't even consider myself a musician in that way. Like, I can't even claim that I know real musicians, you know. But I can write. I use them as kind of like writing tools. Sometimes I can record myself doing it, but I'm not proficient. I'm probably more proficient on a flute than I am on any of them.
So in a world full of instruments, why the flute?
Natural, how I got there, how I discovered it. With instruments, you pick them up and you mess around with them and you start to see, where am I spending most of my time? And it ended up being the flute. But then I go through phases too, because I did it with guitar for a little bit, then I did it with bass for a little bit, and then flute just happened to be the thing that I think stuck. And because I think the mobileness of a flute too, because I mean, right now I'm holding the flute. I carry it kind of everywhere. So any inspiration I get, I just pick it up and start messing around. I can't do that with a bass guitar. I can't do that with a piano. You can do it with a guitar, acoustic maybe, but this is so unassuming, and you just kind of carry it like a, you know. So I think that the portability of a flute probably made it my favorite.
How many do you own?
About 30 flutes maybe.
So you have 30 versions of that?
No, and they're all from different makers, but this style of flute, I probably own more of these in my double flutes than any other style, because it's kind of the flute that I really fell in love with first. Which is based in like Mesoamerican culture, you know, Mayan and Aztec flutes. And now this is the Native American version of them, made by Guillermo. They were made of clay originally, but I own a lot of these. But I think once I started to go on the flute path, I started to get schooled by Uber drivers, because I play all the time. So I play in Ubers, I play in cab, I play in the back.
Word?
Yeah. And so if I'm playing and it's a Chinese driver, he'll turn around like, oh man, that reminds me of my country. Or if it's Japanese, oh, that reminds me. Or if it's African, oh, it reminds me. So everybody, I'm playing the same flute, but every nationality of driver will turn around and tell me it reminds them of their country. So that let me know that culturally, every culture has a flute.
Okay.
And a drum, of course. But Yeah, but I started to get schooled on the street and by Uber drivers while people asking me about things. Like, I was in Philly shooting the film, and I spent a lot of time in Philly, and I would just walk and play. And this dude comes up to me, and he's like, oh, you're doing that Japanese thing. And I was like, what Japanese thing are you talking about? And then he schools me and tell me that there was a whole shakuhachi culture where, you know, these Japanese players would walk around with baskets on their head to have no identity and no ego and just play for people. That was it. And I would just walk around in public and play. So he was asking me, was I doing that, which I had no idea what that was, and went to research that and learned about that.
I was going to say, there's a show that came on in the 70s called Kung Fu.
Yes.
And of which David Carradine's character sort of, and he, Tarantino sort of alluded to that in Kill Bill, in mm-hmm. which he played the same exact flute, like just walk around and start playing. And okay. So yeah, I was wondering like, wow, I wonder if he's in his Kung Fu phase.
No, it's just, I'm being taught, I'm learning. And I see now that anything that I can blow wind through and manipulate the notes with my fingers, I want to play it. So if I'm turned on to a Persian Ney flute or Indian Bansuri flute or like a Chinese gourd, like I just like discovering things that I can blow, you know, and it's fun, you know.
How long did it take you, for muscle memory's sake, to, I get the feeling you're going to say, I have yet to master the flute. But
oh yeah, man.
No. I mean, but you do know, like, and right now when you're playing, are your hands telling you what to do, or do you know that this particular position will yield this note and that note? And
no, that's the fun and scary part about how I play. Like when people hear the record, like we made it up as it was going, so I'm discovering that melody as it's going along. But I don't know what I'm doing until I do it. So like I couldn't, like if you played a note for me right now on a keyboard, I could not tell you what that note was. If you played a chord, I couldn't tell you. I understand when musicians talk about a key center or, you know, the bottom of this chord, but I don't know what that is. None of that. For me, it's all physical and it's all shapes. So I do know if I take one finger and spread, I can't say it on the microphone or how to say it, but do these ET kind of fingers, I know that gives me an odd note. That's all I know. I know it's odd, which may be a flat or something. Mm-hmm. And I know if I put all my fingers down, I get a certain thing. So when I'm playing, I'm actually responding to what note I just played before, not knowing what that note is. So everything is on a tightrope.
So you're taking one step at a time?
Purely one step at a time, but it is very physical. It is very physical because I'm trying to wheel something out because I know I never trained. So I have to find another way, another route to get to it.
How often do you practice a day?
I wouldn't even call it practice, which I'm now getting into practice. Like, because I started playing flute, like I'm actually meeting like kick-ass flute players. Like someone introduced me to Shabaka. And so Shabaka will show me exercises. Like but I've never done that before. And so I'm learning how to practice. I never went to college or anything. So I don't even have like the, I just never had to study. Right. So I don't have that in me. It's always playing. I just try to play as much as possible, which ends up being study. So even before, I'm just always out playing, but I don't have a regimen really, you know?
Fun fact, you're speaking for at least 70% of all musicians out there. Like, I play by ear.
Yeah.
I mean, I've just recently, maybe in the last 20 years, and only because like some of the more intellectual roots will eye roll, because I didn't know previously how to say, like, play a C-sharp sus.
Yeah, you know, see, I know those words, but that's foreign to me.
Right, but for a majority of creatives, there's two types of musicians, technical musicians and musicians that feel. I'm a feel musician.
Mm-hmm, totally feel.
Like, if you were to put notate notes in front of me, I wouldn't know what the hell is in front of me, so I got to go on feel.
Yeah, that's all I have, man. That's all I kind of... And the thing about hip hop too, hip hop forces you to do the immediate thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just a certain energy that, I don't know. We just kind of have this kind of flying by the seat of our pants kind of thing. And so when I put it towards an instrument, I'm kind of transferring it in that way of like, we just try stuff. Like, we pick up something that's not supposed to be for a thing and make it for something else. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm using a lot of that.
How did you assemble the musicians for New Blue Sun? How did it come together?
It naturally came about by me meeting Carlos Nino.
Yeah. Okay.
We met. It's such a Venice story. We met in Erewhon. Yeah, no joke. We met in Erewhon. And Mike D from Beastie Boys was there at the meeting because I saw him in line checking out. And I went up to him, "What's up, man?" You know. And then Carlos comes up, so it's three of us standing right here at the cash register.
Right.
And Carlos invites us out to an event that he's doing that night. And we kind of started hanging out since then. He had heard that I was in town in Venice, and people were like, "I think y'all need to meet," you know. And some people would say that to Carlos. And Carlos was like, "Yeah, I'm going to meet him, you know, at some point, you know." And we finally ended up meeting, and he invited me over to his house. We recorded in his garage. And that was kind of like our first kind of getting into it. And I knew I wanted to work on this wind project. And I knew a lot of the sounds that I was looking for. That's what Carlos does. And so when he was brought into the fold, he's like, "Man, I know a lot of people I could bring, you know, to help." And so we tried out a lot of different outfits, you know, different situations. And the core four of us ended up being
Surya and Nate as
well.
Yeah,
Surya and Nate. And but that ended up being the core. And then we would invite just anybody in to come and, you know, hang out. But yeah, this album definitely couldn't have been made without Carlos Nino. Like, Nino is, what I love about Nino is he reminds me of when I was producing early on for Outkast. Like, there's a certain excitement. Like, he's more concerned with what's the most interesting thing.
Okay.
You know, and I love that. It's like a kind of kid spirit, you know.
So, okay, in the credits of the album, under Carlos's title, there's also, it's listed as gongs, various instruments, and then there's plants.
Mm-hmm.
How are plants a part of the instrumentation of this album?
I mean, you'll see when we play live, but sounds are everywhere, man. Anything is a sound. You know, we've only settled on certain instruments because we're used to them, but... Like, Carlos may just grab a palm leaf off the side of the road and shake it.
Oh, okay. I see.
You know what I mean? So
I get it.
Anything. Like, it could be a beanstalk, a dry big, anything. You know, just whatever makes a cool noise that you like. And Carlos has, like, man, a myriad of sounds, of stuff, anything. Like, yeah, and plants happen to be one of them.
So what's the division of labor as far as the technical aspect? I'm only asking this because when I read the credits to your album, there's a name there, a legendary Philadelphia name, gentleman named Andy Kravitz.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Andy mastered this album.
Yes.
Now, Andy Kravitz, to me, is a very legendary Philadelphia native.
Drummer.
We got our record deal in 1993. I used to intern at Raphael's Records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so Andy Kravitz was sort of like a house producer at Studio 54. So I'm there like when he's working with Tim Dog. He's played on Steady B stuff. And so I, you know, he was like really the first hip hop drummer I've seen with my own eyes. Nothing. Sorry, Full Bobby circle. Simmons of Stetsasonic. Forgive me. But yeah, Andy Kravitz, and then he just disappeared off the radar for like 20. And I always wondered what happened to him. So yeah. He's mastering...
Yeah, it's so cool that the relationship, like Carlos has worked with him before. And okay. So his mastering studio is in Venice. So it was all in the neighborhood. So like his mastering studio is right by the beach. And we just kind of go to his house and he got like crazy equipment, like Neve boards and a little bitty ass apartment. It's awesome. Like,
so basically I have to move to Venice. Why Venice?
I have no idea, man. Like I got here happenstance, like, I wasn't even supposed to be living in Venice. And then this real estate agent lady, she was like, "Hey, check out this little house I got in Venice. I mean, just check it out." And all my friends in LA, they were like, "Please, man, don't move to Venice." Like,
all right.
LA people be like, "Man, we'll never see you because that's on the west side. That's way..."
Yeah, I was going to say it's beautiful. But then I was like, "Ah, man, so much on Sunset and all my favorite restaurants. I would never..." No, I'm not doing
it. But I never get back on that side, though. Like, everything I need is pretty much over here. And I think all of that, like... me moving to Venice catapulted me in the direction I needed to go. And I will say that because I went to a breathwork class in Venice. Mm-hmm. That's when I first heard this certain kind of flute that I love. And it was all because of Venice. So I have to say sometimes them certain breadcrumbs or wherever you are are for a reason. And you may not even know it at the time, but mm-hmm. if I didn't move to Venice, this album probably wouldn't have been made.
Okay.
Not in this way. You know?
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte Gallo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
Came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What was the banner year or the starting year of your flute curiosity?
I don't know the actual starting year, but I will say, because me and Carlos were just talking about it the other day. Since The Love Below, I've been interested in wind instruments. Like, I've messed around with saxophone, even on like in She Lives in My Life at the end. The horrible saxophone, that's me messing around with saxophone.
Oh, I thought you had a free jazz saxophone player.
Like, nah, that's me. That's me.
That was you?
Yeah, that's me playing. That's me messing around.
I have to re-listen to that. Okay.
It's horrible. It's horrible. But it was like...
Is it though? I don't believe in wrong notes. And yeah. I love... Yeah. Now I got to go back and listen again.
No, you hear.
The thing is, if you do it with a straight face and confidence...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's always for real now. It's serious. Even if it's horrible, you're going to believe it.
Okay, I just thought you had some free jazz. Okay, now I have to revisit that.
So yeah, I started wanting to play saxophone first, tenor saxophone, because of John Coltrane. I mean, because I was a fan of John Coltrane, and me reading bios of John mm-hmm. Coltrane, I learned that he played clarinet in school first mm-hmm. before he switched over to. So I was like, well, let me give me a clarinet. So I bought a clarinet, straight B flat, the straight one, mm-hmm. B flat clarinet, and I played around with it for a few months, and then we were on tour, and I went to a pawn shop in New York, mm-hmm. and there was a Selmer bass clarinet. I don't know why I was there, and I was like, this, it looked cool. A lot of times I'm attracted to an instrument because of the way it looked. Mm-hmm. And so I saw it, and it was in its case, it was open, and it happened to be like a 1967 Selmer bass clarinet. Bought it, and as soon as I started playing it, like, and the thing is, with wind players, it's a thing called embouchure. It's kind of like how your mouth fits over the tip of the reed mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. It's weird, but I was just blessed to immediately have an embouchure. Like, my first time picking it up and putting my mouth on it, was like, I'm getting a good tone, like a good sound. So it motivated me to even want to play more, you know? So from there, once I hit the bass clarinet, I noticed that I love the deeper tones, and I love wind on wood mm-hmm. Compared to metal, which is, you know, soprano or, which yeah, I tried a little soprano too.
Okay.
So from there, it's just me loving what I could get out of wind instruments. So I even got into oboe, which is the hardest one to play. Like, I love the oboe sound. Got into oboe, went into oboe day. Which right. is, yeah, oboe day at the new school, they have like oboe day. Okay. You see what I'm saying? Like Dre Day, but oboe day.
Right. Okay. I was like, is that a pun or? Okay.
Oboe day.
I get it.
So, yeah, when I moved to New York, I would just kind of look at the school schedule of whatever performances were at the new school, because I always like to go where the youth is performing new music. I don't care. Like, there's something about that college age where you're dumb enough to try new things, but you're developed enough to do them well. And mm-hmm. It's about that period. And so I would just go to the new school and see whatever recitals are playing. I don't care, piano one night, it could be bassoonist another night, or a whole orchestra. And I just sit there and listen. And
side question, are you freaking people out as you're like just wandering into their school?
Not really.
Or into their pawn shop?
No, I just, you know, talk to the students. You know, they'd be like, oh, he came to the show. But it would be maybe 15 people in there, like 10 people just sitting.
Okay.
So it was not like a big production or anything. So I could easily just slip in, slip out. But just my interest in wind instruments just kept growing. And so I would just collect different wind instruments. And then I discovered the Guillermo, the Maya double flute, mm-hmm. which is kind of what really pushed me into wanting to play it all the time. And maybe, like, even with a bass clarinet, you have to, it's like a gun, you have to construct it. Put it together, put it back in the case, clean it, you know. Mm-hmm. With these, it was so instant, I can just carry it around. So it was very instant, and I think because I could carry it, I kept it with me longer than any other instrument. So, yeah, I've been interested in wind for a long time. But
okay.
Yeah.
So this album marks a return to the spotlight for you for the first time in, as of this recording, 17 years. Basically meaning you haven't released product with your name on it since 2006.
My own product, yes.
Your own product, yeah. Right. Even though you've done things here and there. Could you describe, if you can go back that far, 2007? Like a year after...
What's 2007?
Well, a year after 2006 where, you know, you're starting your... I'm sure then you didn't think of it as, I'm going to start my exile or my rest from my day job that people know me from. But like a year or two after it, when you're not in daily motion of got to have an album out, got to figure out a tour, got to da-da, like,
yeah, yeah.
What was 2007 like for you? You were 32 years old.
I don't remember, but...
That's cool, too.
Yeah, because it's hard for me to place the dates. Like, you have to give me kind of like a marker. That's like, right. That was a year after The Love Below came out, or a year before Idlewild, or, like, I kind of have to mark
it. I think a year after... Idlewild came out in 2006, so I say a year after Idlewild then?
A year after Idlewild, at home, and I was blessed to start getting asked to be on remixes.
Okay.
And that was a blessing for me because it gave me a chance to rap. You know, after all that had happened.
That's so weird. You see it as a blessing.
Like, no, because it feel good to rap. So whenever you get the like the opportunity to do it and you in it. Like,
I know,
yeah.
But like, okay, so I remember once when you appeared on the remix of
Walk It Out.
Walk It Out, right.
Yeah, yeah.
And the, so I know you're not on social media. So to see the social media reaction to you even being on that remix, one was a shocker. Like, wait, Andre 3000 is on a Walk It Out song and with Jim Jones, whatever. So, but it was such a mind-blowing thing. But in my mind, I was like, wow, I wonder if he notices like that. And again, I mean this with no pressure, no intent of pressure. Like, you're kind of holding the world's oxygen supply, you know, hostage, because you can spit a verse and it's guaranteed that at least three things that you say in that verse will be like, holy shit, you already coupled those words together. Like, it's an event. I've seen people, like, for instance, the verse on the Rick Ross thing. Mm. Like, I didn't think I'd ever experience coming from a place where we would have daily meetings about, wait, what about this? And you just start doing your PowerPoint thing and the way you juxtapose these words together. But,
oh, man.
So it's just weird to hear you say, like, oh, I'm just so blessed to be able to get the opportunity to do that. And I'm like,
no. And when I
you
say,
are the opportunity.
No, but see, when I say blessing, you got to understand, too, this is a town, a town creating a new sound, too. So DJ Unk, like, that actually came through another DJ friend of mine that know Unk. And Unk just said, hey, ask Andre if he'd get on this beat. And it came that way. It was nothing, no big production. Like, I don't even know if I got paid for the song. Like, I think the trade-off was, hey, Unc, can you do a couple of beats that we scratched in the background of my cartoon? That'll be the payment for class of 3000.
Right, okay.
So
okay.
I think it was set up that way, but the beat was so jamming,
right,
that you just wanted to get on it. So I say the blessing because any rapper just want to be on a good beat and be in the city. You know, you just want to be out. You want to be heard. So
right.
If producers are making new sounds or even later, new artist, so even if a Frank Ocean says, hey, get on my song. Frank Ocean, a new artist, I don't know him. Mm-hmm. Like, get on my song. But when I say a blessing, that reintroduced me to a whole nother generation, too.
Right.
Okay. You know what I mean? That were following that. You right. know, so I do look at it as blessings. And I say blessing because we had just come off of Speaker Box Love Below, Idlewild, which was a musical, more focused, mm-hmm. melodic kind of thing. And so I didn't rap a lot
okay.
in those offerings, a little bit. So when I say a blessing, it gave me another opportunity to do what I enjoy doing. Yeah.
What five albums can you not live without? What five albums can you not live without?
That's a hard
pressure.
One, man. Yeah. You should have gave me some time to answer this before we got on this microphone, man.
Well, the thing is, I think oftentimes when people are in this high pressure situation of like, I got to give the most intellectual answer. Like sometimes I listen to boring ass shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm on an Elvis kick right now because I just saw the Lisa Marie biopic.
Okay.
And I'm interested in that 68 comeback. Black Leather. So I'm, and plus, you know, the Wrecking Crew were playing on that record. So right now I'm on an Elvis kick.
Okay.
For some strange reason, but it doesn't have to be five.
I've gone through that Elvis kick too.
Really?
Yeah, man. Like, Elvis was a bad motherfucker, man. Like,
or what five albums would you not expect us to think that you're into?
Not think that I'm into? That's another thing, because when you say your five albums, it's almost like I'm trying not to give you the ones that everybody's going to say too. So I'm double thinking. Like, if I say, you know, Love Supreme,
so
like,
right,
you know what I mean? It's kind of like, that's everybody's, you know what I mean? So I'm trying to figure out, that's a good question. What?
Okay. So everyone has a go-to song that they put on to just calm them down. And yo, when the album came out, I hit you with 12 paragraphs. I'm certain the whole world was hitting you with paragraphs. But you know, okay, I won't say an album, because what's an album in 2023? What music, what's your go-to music that you escape to?
It's different phases, man. And just like you're saying right now, you're into an Elvis phase. Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm into like a kind of classical Steve Reichish kind of.
Oh, okay.
It's very repetitive, calming, and meditative at the same time, but at the same time, like very complex and moving. It's like, and it's rhythmic, you know, it's tight, you know. So I guess I'm into that. And I listen to like a lot of native drum circle music, like Cree Indian, Cree Nation kind of drumming. The way they sing, man, yeah, that just blows my mind. Something very powerful.
Okay.
About that.
Is there any lyric that is ever stuck in your head? A stanza or a lyric of any song? Or I've been working on this slide documentary for so long that I think I almost every day hear the last line of Family Affair. Like, you can't cry because you look broke down, but you're crying away because you're all broke down. So that's stuck in my head. Like, are there lyrics that are often just stuck in your head? Even if it's dumb. I met her in a hotel lobby, like anything.
Like the song Fast Car by Tracy Chapman, like, is one of those songs that I wish, you know, people ask you, man, what song do you wish you
would have written? Do you wish you wrote?
Yeah, like as a child hearing that song, it introduced me to, oh, you can actually hit people in the heart with words, you know. Right. And when she said the line, something like, "Is body's too young for body's too old for working, but body's too young to look like his. My mama went off and left him. She wanted more than he could give. Somebody's got to take care of him. So I quit school." I was like, "Whoa,
whew." Yeah. You wish you wrote that.
Yeah, it was like. We were listening and watching a real life. Like, it's almost like the black kind of trailer park story. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
And you were on the ride the whole time, like these big dreams of her and this dude.
And someone running away from a past life.
And it went full circle.
Right.
Like, she had these big dreams just like her mama did. Then at the end, she got to keep moving. Like, whoa.
Right.
Hard.
Okay. Yeah. Anyone that's ever asked me, like, what song that I wish I wrote or a part of, I will never hesitate to say, nothing will ever beat the moment in which we were in our tour bus. We had 1 week to finish our Things Fall Apart album. Mm-hmm. We were coming back from Pittsburgh. And this is August of 98.
Okay.
And, you know, back in the day, of course, your album had to be done like 3 months ahead of time.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah.
So somehow my publicist was connected to Drew Dixon at Arista and had a copy of Equimini. Hmm. And the feeling of fear when Spodioli Dopalicious came on, I was like, fuck, they sound like a better band than we do. Like, and instantly I knew, like, every black university marching band, like, this was going to be something I heard, like, forever. And I was like, damn, how come my ideas don't come to me like that, man? Like, what the fuck? You know, and plus, it's very rare, it's rare in which you hear stream of conscious thinking. Black people thinking. And man, that paralyzed me so goddamn much, man. Like, I wish.
I don't know if I should say thank you or sorry. You know what I mean?
No, it made me try harder, man. And I've yet to still create that. So, like, in my mind, that's what I'm doing.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
It actually, best piece of advice, I would say, came from Erica's grandmother. Erica's grandmom would always say, anything, any problem, any issue that come up, she'd be like, ah, keep on living. It'll happen to you. That was it.
Yeah, just keep on. Did you know what she meant?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Keep on living, it'll happen to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's as simple as that. It's going to happen. Keep on living, it'll happen to you.
If you can astral travel back to 1992,
mm-hmm.
and you today were allowed a 20-second window to disrupt the timeline and talk to yourself, and I believe you were 17 in 1992, what would you tell yourself in those 20 seconds?
This is like before first album?
92, I consider that the beginning of the podcast.
What would I tell myself? Get ready for the ride, man. Get ready for a ride that you don't even know how to hold on. Because you can't even fathom what's going to happen. You know? So I don't know if there's any more advice than that. Just get ready for the ride and just, yeah. Yeah, because there's nothing to prepare you for. Because we can have plans, like as humans, you just want to rap.
Okay.
But those are kind of on the ground, you know, goals. But then there's a higher force that takes you further and that things that I couldn't even imagine, that I couldn't even think about. So really just get ready for the ride.
Most people, when they dream, they often have themes that occur all the time.
Yep.
Trains are always in my dream. For at least the last 30 years, trains are always in my dream. What is the prevalent theme of all of your dreams?
Flying.
You're always on a plane?
No, I'm always flying. No plane.
Do you have a fear of flying?
No.
Besides trains, and this is weird. I live in an apartment in New York, and I'm on the 73rd floor. And people always ask all the time, wait, aren't you afraid to be up here? You know, that sort of thing. But yet, when I sleep, because I often believe that times your brain can't register fantasy in real life.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried an exercise where, you know, I was watching somebody on YouTube and they said, like, imagine yourself flying. And when I closed my eyes to stand on a ledge to make that leap,
I get that. I can't imagine myself, even in my dreams, I can't imagine myself flying over. Like it's the same fear as if I were on the ledge and want to hang on to dear life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in your dreams, you have the ability to just transport and fly.
Yes. And it was from wherever I am, like I have to be on the top of a building. Like I can be on the ground and I start to do this type. It's almost like a hover. Like it's like a floating kind of thing. And you're kind of like, it's not like direct control. It's almost like you're drifting and you're able to manipulate the drift a little bit, but not fast. So if I want to make a turn, I got to start drifting a little. But yeah, like I'm always flying. I'm looking down on the world. Like I'm looking down on mountains. I'm looking down on things. But here's the craziest thing. Whenever I try to show my friends, like I remember in one dream I was trying to show C-Law, like, see, look, man, check this out. And I tried to do it for him. It didn't work. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like you want to share this thing.
So when you
were
planning it, you couldn't do it. But when it just
happened. When I was by myself and it was happening, I was like, whoa, look at this flying thing. And now at this point, I want to show people. You almost like, I almost want to show off the trick. Like, oh, check this out. And whenever I try, it just doesn't work. Which is weird, you know. But I have that dream a lot. And it's the same flying style. It's kind of like it's a really awesome style. Because it's...
Because even in your dreams, you're cool as shit.
Because it's so floaty. It's so floaty. It's not like a plane ship where I'm able to make quick rights or anything. So it's almost like... It's hard.
Okay. I get
try to describe dreams on a microphone. It's hard, man.
I get it.
Like, it's hard.
Who are three of the most, in your career, who are three of the most important people that you've met?
L.A. Reid, who signed us, mm-hmm. Big Boy. And I say third, I'd have to say collectively, The Dungeon. Those are the most important.
Okay.
You know, because, and for different reasons, but well, L.A. Reid, of course, he gave us our first opportunity, mm-hmm. You know, so he saw enough in us to sign us, to give us an opportunity to do something. Big Boy, because he's my high school friend that started this whole thing with me that, oh, we can do this, you know, mm-hmm. And not only that, just contributing in like a music form, but in a motivational form too, because Big Boy knows me more than anybody and he knows, you know, when I'm not feeling a certain thing or, you know, when I've given up in a way. And Big Boy's always been kind of like the chili. Like I remember before our first album came out, our first showcase, people didn't like us, you know, and we got the feedback from that showcase when all labels would come and you would do your act and, mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of funny to think about it now. But we got word that, you know, some feedback was, oh, they're okay, they're not stars. You know, that was the feedback. And so at that point, I remember we were kind of sad. We were at The Dungeon and I was like, oh, well, shit, man. I'm going to go ahead and do this art thing. I thought I'd be drawing and painting. Like, that's what I started doing. Mm-hmm. The plan was like, all right, well, I'm just going to art school now. You know, this rap thing is not working. And so Big Boy is kind of the person like, no, man, we done came this far. Let's do it. So that value, importance in my life and career. The Dungeon, because they created an environment to show me, to make me feel comfortable enough to do all the things that y'all are seeing now. Like, you have to have a good ground to feel comfortable enough to try stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, okay. You've seen it. You're a producer. You've been in the studio. Like, you've gotten certain things out of artists when they're open and you know, freer than if they're, you know, nervous or, you know, they're scared to fuck up, mm-hmm. You know, or scared to not be great. You know, you got to create that environment. And I think The Dungeon created that environment for me to, for me to know how to dream. Like, they taught me, they taught me how to get out, you know?
What's the hidden talent that you possess that the world doesn't know about?
Drawing, painting,
sculpting. You still actively paint right now and sculpt?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you into selling your work?
Yes, very soon. Stay tuned. Very soon.
Yeah, I want to be for, because that's, I collect works from different artists.
Yeah, man.
So
yeah.
Finally, George Clinton gave me an official piece. And
right. Yeah, man. I can't wait to share it because it's a whole nother thing. And I've been sharing it a little bit, but only like on Outkast CDs.
Yeah.
All the artwork. Sketches, a little quick. And that's another thing. That was a Big Boy thing. Like, I did it one time for the first album, and then Big Boy's like, you going to do another one for the next one? I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? So it became a thing. Because
so you've done all that artwork of on the actual CD, disc?
Yeah, on the disc. Yeah.
Okay, that's your work. Okay,
yeah, and I call myself more of a like a classroom drawer more than anything. I wouldn't say I'm full fledged. I'm learning how to paint now, but yeah, I've been doing it for a while now, and I'm loving that I'm finding what I am, loving that I'm finding my style, and can't wait to share it. But that I cook.
How good?
I have to cook, and you have to tell me. Like, but people that have had food, they enjoy it. And I really be doing the same thing that my mom and my dad have showed me, just recipes they showed me. So it's like,
what's your go-to jam?
Salmon patties and cheese grits.
Okay.
Or fried fish. My dad had a fish shop on Riverdale Road.
Okay.
And my mom taught me, recipes. And I'm only child, so I cooked for myself a lot. So I had that skill to do it. So.
Okay.
Other talents, I can make water noises with my mouth.
Okay.
You want to hear them?
Hit me. Andre 3000, ladies and gentlemen. What's the greatest cereal of all time?
Woo! I would have to say, you got to eat it quick. But them Fruity Pebbles, though, like,
oh, before it become super soggy.
Yeah. Them Fruity Pebbles, man, they something else.
Okay. The story that you told me before we started taping about Coachella night one.
Yeah, man.
Could you share that story?
Yeah, for sure. Okay. And it's funny, for a long time, I wasn't sure if I, when people pass away, you just want to kind of respect.
Right.
But I think Prince would, I think he would enjoy it. So yeah, I've met Prince in passing. Like, when I was finishing up The Love Below, I lived in LA. Mm-hmm. And I remember me and a homie going out to a club on Sunset, normal night. And I say, hey, I'm going to use the bathroom. I'm walking away to use the bathroom. And this big, huge bodyguard dude comes and grabs me. He say, hey, Prince is in the corner. He wants to meet you. And so that was my first time meeting Prince, when I got to pee.
What year is this?
Oh, man, this was...
Well, you're making The Love Below, so...
That's... No, actually, this was Hey Y'all was already out. Hey Y'all was out. Yeah, and that's the only... Like, the whole album...
You were just meeting him then?
No, the album had just come out. Right. Yeah, I hadn't met him before.
Crap. I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, all my friends had met him. Erica told me stories. I never met him. But, so this bodyguard... mind you, I still got to pee.
Right.
So, I go over to this booth... And it's Prince, and he's sitting, and I'm very nervous, man. He, motions his hand like, sit down, man. So I go and sit down, and I didn't know what to say. And he could tell that I didn't know what to say.
Right.
So he was like, it's all good, man. He didn't say all good, but he was like, it's okay, or something like that. He's like, it's okay. He's like, we don't have to talk about everything now. That's what we say. We don't have to say everything now. He's like, you can come out to Paisley Park. He invited, and which I'd never been to Paisley Park, but... And so I'm sitting there, and so he starts talking about Hey Y'all. And I didn't know if it was.
Did that freak you out?
It did.
That he knew you were alive, that you existed.
Yes, but what he said, I didn't know how to take it. I didn't know if he was taking a dig at me or what, because he said, I like that song, Hey Y'all, man. He was like, I thought I was the only person that did songs in those tempos. That's what he said to me. And I didn't know if he was like, take that, nigga. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? I didn't know how to take it. This is my hero.
No, like, I think he considered you a peer. Like,
I don't know. And so naturally, the album had just come out, and we were trying to figure out what's the next single.
Right.
And so I didn't know what to say to him, and I just said, "Hey, have you heard the album?" He's like, "Yeah, I've heard it." And then I said, "Well, what do you think the next single should be?" Then he said another Prince thing. He said, in my day, we only had one shot. So basically, he was saying it don't matter now.
Right.
Whatever you do, it don't matter.
Right.
And I didn't know how to take that either. You know, it was like, okay, cool. The next time I saw Prince, I'm and it's always random. So I'm walking down the street, like close to Rodeo by myself, and a limo pulls up close to me. I swear to all the gods, man.
No, dude, every Prince story is this random.
Yes, I know, because I've heard them too.
Yes.
And so this window rolls down and this little head pops out and it's Prince in the limo. And he said, "What's up, man?" I was like, "What's up, man?" You know, and then he was like, "You heard about this? Some I can't say. I remember which magazine, but they opposed the thing. Oh, we want to put you and Prince on the cover of a magazine together." And Prince said, "You heard about that? I don't know if it rap page. I don't know what
Complex.
I have no idea which magazine it was, but I was like, yeah, I heard about it. And I was asking him, like, what do you think?" And he said, "Don't let them do you like that." Yeah. And I still,
that
still,
is
you said, like, I don't know. But now, like, in retrospect, I think what he meant was don't let them boil you down to being next to me.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's what I got from it. Like, you know what I mean? And people will try to put you in them boxes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I respected that from him. You know what I mean? He was like, "You're more than whatever people are saying." You know what I mean? And that's what I took from. So fast forward.
Yeah.
I hadn't talked to him or seen him that whole time. Big Boy done toured 10 years. Mm-hmm. So we have this Coachella opportunity. It's Outkast 20 years.
Wait, you must really be off the radar because Prince is super, like, I will see him in the most random situations.
Yeah.
So you're saying 10 years went by before you saw him again?
Yeah, I think it was 7 to 10 years.
Damn. Maybe. Okay.
But I'd moved from LA too. So
okay.
I only saw him in LA. I think he was hanging out right here a lot. So the Coachella opportunity comes up. I was kind of like whatever about it. Like, you know, there were certain times I didn't even remember my raps. You know, I was just kind of like, all right, whatever, let's go out here and do it. Mm-hmm. So the first night of the first weekend of Coachella, nerves, like I hadn't been on stage. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, that's not my normal every day anymore. Mm-hmm. Big Boy does it every night. So this is normal to him. Mm-hmm. So I'm coming out the dressing room. They start the show. I'm walking to the stage and I see Paul McCartney walk to the left side of the stage and sit. I saw Prince walk to the right side of the stage.
Oh, no.
And sit.
Oh, God. I'm sorry, Andre, man.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, man.
You see what I'm saying? Tyler, the creator, just met us backstage. Tyler is new.
I'm sorry, man.
We talking. He came backstage. We tripping.
Right.
I'm nervous as fuck. I'm walking to the stage.
Right.
And I see these gods standing on both sides of the stage. Mind you, my whole career, I've never used in-ears, you know, the monitors. We always just worked off of whatever speakers on stage. Uh-huh. My first time ever using in-ears, and they're acting up. So they're clipping out. I'm hearing people, voices I don't even know, talking in my ear. I'm like, what the fuck?
Right.
So it was a disaster to me. Like, mm-hmm. I was trying to get through it. I didn't know how to do it anymore. Like, it was just a new awakening for an old thing that I used to do. So halfway through the show, I'm checked out. Like, I'm already just trying to get through it. I'm just trying to get through the night, you know. I'm already in my bed. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I walked off stage, I went home and went straight to sleep. When you crash, you go straight to sleep.
Right.
Like, it's like a bad night. So you just let me go to sleep and, you know, wake up in the morning. So when I woke up and I'm driving back to L.A., my manager called and said, "Hey, Prince wants to talk to you." So he calls. I don't know where he got the number from.
Yeah, he does that.
Yeah, so he should work for, like, the Secret Service.
Right, exactly.
Like, but he calls and it's Prince on the phone. I'm like, "Hey, man." I'm like, you know, I don't even know. Like, I got Prince on the fucking phone.
Right.
First thing he says, "You know what your problem is?" He goes in straight like that. He said, "You don't understand how big y'all are." And of course, I'm telling him my sob story, like, "Yeah, man, you know, I ain't really been wanting to do it anymore. Like, I don't like doing old songs." He was like, And he this is him. He's saying, I've been there, man. Like, I know exactly what you mean. I've been there where I don't want to do those songs. Blah, blah, blah. But he said, but you're a grown man. You signed up to do these shows. So do them. Just like that. And so that conversation made me have to re-figure out, how can I make these shows exciting to me? Mm-hmm. You know, how can I be in it? And that's when the idea to try to put messages on my uniform every night, what got me excited.
Where are those uniforms?
We have them in storage.
All of them?
All of them.
Okay.
So my biggest excitement of that tour was figuring out what I was going to say that night. Because I was trying to say something new. Like, here's my thing. I love the blessing of the songs that we've been given. I don't like performing old songs, really. I just don't, because I'm in a whole nother space and I have to kind of get back in a, remember what that felt like to do that. And I don't necessarily like doing that. It's almost like playing dress up mm-hmm. to an eighth grade picture that you saw. And now you're trying to re-be that person again.
Right.
And so I was trying to figure out, how do I make this exciting, this tour? And so the messages on the suits were just fun to me. It was just hilarious. What can I do to make it fun? That's how I got through it. And that gave me something, an entry way to make this exciting. And that's, but back to Prince, another thing too. So when I was telling him about, how I felt, and he was like, yeah, I've been there. He's like, but you got to do these shows. You're a grown man. And then he said, so back when he was like, you got to remind people who you are. It's like, when you've been gone for a long time, you have to remind people who you are every time. He's like, you got to do that first. This is him telling me, like, you got to do that first, and then you can do whatever. He actually said, if you remind people what you do first, you can shave off all your hair and tell them to do it, and they will do it. These are his words. Mm-hmm. And he said, I learned that from Mary J. Blige. This is Prince telling me. He's like, I toured, I did a couple of shows with her, and I'm trying to do all this new stuff, and she's doing what people know. And he said, I learned that from Mary, to give the people what they want first. Then you can do whatever you want after that. And him trying to, I guess, plead his case about reminding people who y'all are, he started naming artists. And I won't name the names because I don't think it's about these names. Mm-hmm. But he was like, this person, this person, this person, none of these people would be here if it wasn't for y'all. And you have to remember that. And you have to remind people of that all the time. So, and then he said, and this is, I guess, the musician in him. He was like, and why you didn't play your guitar on Hey Y'all on stage? Why you didn't do it? I was like, I'm not like a great guitarist or anything. You know, it's like I know how to play a couple of chords. He's like, but you're good enough. You should have played it. Right. So, he digging it. And then I didn't tell everybody at the time because I wanted to keep the momentum together. But he totally dissed our band.
Right.
Yeah. He's like, and what's up with that fucking band? This is Prince saying, what's up with that fucking band? And at that point, I was like, man, I really didn't want a band. I was trying to find a new way to be modern looking on stage or something like that. Anyway, mm-hmm. I said, but, I'm in a group and, we have to be fair about decisions. And I'm telling Prince about mm-hmm. my inner,
right.
my inner decision with me and Big, Big, like, I want the band, shit, that's, these are our folks, we're supporting our band, which I'm with on that. But I wanted to do something new, but we are together in this thing. So we made decision to do the band, and it was our first night. So we're trying to get as tight as we can be. But anyway,
right.
He was like, what's up with that band? They sound horrible. Yeah. That's all I remember from that conversation. But yeah,
brother, I just want to say that I've been a long time, long time fan of yours. One of my prime career regrets in the early start is that we never got to shop it up or like work together then in the what I call the fossil years. Yeah. We started our careers 30 years ago, folks. But you're an inspiration in terms of like pushing boundaries. Cause a lot of us are walking out here sort of mired in self-doubt.
Mm.
Thinking of survival first. All right, I gotta get I got to bring this money in so I can, you know, help my mom out obligations and stuff like that. And we never allow ourselves to like break free and dream and take risks and do these things. And, you know, you've proven time and time again that there is a payoff when you do listen to your heart and not, I'm a brain person. I used to be a brain person where I'm always thinking fight or flight, survival first, that sort of thing, and not what do I really feel?
Yeah.
And yeah, man, with New Blue Sun, man, dude, it couldn't have come at a better time in my life because that's the type of music I always listen to just to calm down.
Yeah.
Just to 24/7. That's all I listen to. Yeah. I listen to like Tones and all those things, man. So. No, man. Thank you, man. I appreciate you giving.
I'm glad that it's useful for you, man. Like, I'm just happy to be a part of that this time. You know what I mean? You set an intention and you never know where it's going to land. Like, my idea of what people are calling the flute album, which I think it belittles it to call it a flute album.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's not just a flute. I do play flute on it a bit. I play electronic flute on it. But it's just music, man. It's just music. But
can I ask you something?
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard from Stevie Wonder yet? Because
no, I haven't.
To me, this reminds me. So my father and I, our bond was always bin shopping records.
Yeah.
I grew up in a household with like 3,000 records. Yeah. And so once a month, we just go bin shopping everything. And one day in 1979, he comes home with Stevie Wonder's Journey Through the Secret Life of Plants album, which is like a 3-year follow-up to Songs in the Key of Life. Mm-hmm. Songs in the Key of Life was like one of those events like Thriller, you know, everyone had to have it in the household and we're listening to it together as a family. It brought the family together. And so we're waiting 3 years for this follow-up record and the look of utter disappointment on my dad's face where he's like, Stevie Wonder doesn't even sing until like the fourth song and he couldn't get it.
Yeah.
Now I'm 8 years old in 79. So I've never had a dark side of the moon psychedelic experience. So for me, I'm putting my headphones on and I'm like imagining space and all these things. So I totally took that record different. I think that for a new generation, that this is going to be that for them. Like for me, I use it for meditative and sleeping purposes. Because
I've heard a lot of that, man. Like,
I used to sleep to the news, especially with the past administration.
Yeah,
and it's just unhealthy to have
that bombardment,
NBC on like 24/7, and all the bad news. So then I started sleeping to that. And when your soundtrack, oh man, that to me, that was everything. So I thank you for that, man.
Man, I'm so happy that you're finding use and people are finding use in it. Like, it's become a thing that people are actually using. Like,
it's a tool.
Like, I have to be in traffic, so I put this album on and I'm not mad anymore.
Yes.
You know, like, so I'm happy that I'm a part of something that can contribute positively to somebody's life. You know what I mean? Like, and the sleep thing is really important because I've read, like, a lot of people like, man, I don't really sleep. And I've gotten the best sleep in the last 3 days after listening to the album. So to me, I'm just happy that it's working in that way too, and not just on a, you know, oh, this is a moment, and he's a rapper, and he made this flute thing, you know, like beyond that, you know, and I'm kind of upset that people are upset, but I understand because if you've been waiting for a thing for 17 years, which I haven't been waiting for a thing, that's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I've never said, hey, I'm about to put this solo album out. Hey, I'm about to put this solo album out. I didn't do that for 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't see it the same as like when I put it out, I forgot, oh, it has been 17 years. So I didn't see it as, hey, fuck y'all, listen to this. I just saw this. This is where I am right now. You know, put it out. I didn't think that it would have as wide of wings as it's had. I'm happy for it.
Are you planning on the visual aspect of it now? Are you trying to figure out how to present this live, either by film or some sort, like what Solange used to do, take over museums and
both. We did shoot a film to it that's going to be playing mid December.
Okay,
very simple kind of thing. It's going to be in IMAX theaters, so you'll have a visual to it. But live, man, like that's what I'm really looking forward to, because that's honestly, that's the kind of jewel and the magic in it. Just kind of like the feeding off of each other and making that thing, you know, it's kind of like watching a formation. Like, and we don't know, especially I'm not a trained musician. So it's even more surprising to me when a note comes out or something falls a certain way. You're like,
when it lands right. Right.
And you don't know it. Like, I don't know, like music theory wise to make something land. I only know how to land because I jumped up before it. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
So that's the only way that I know. So doing it live and actually doing music with these brothers, like, that's the fun. And I can't wait for people to experience in a room watching us do it. You know what I mean? So that's what I'm looking forward to.
Well, let's have it. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of my fellow Questlove Supremers, Laia and Fontigalo and Unpaid Bill, and it's your birthday today as we do this. Shout out to Brian and cousin Jake and Brittany as well on the home front. Once again, the great Andre 3000 on Questlove Supreme. And we'll see you on the next go round. Thank you, brother. Appreciate it.
No, thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Questlove Supreme, hosted by Amir Questlove Thompson, Laia St. Clair, Fonte Coleman, Sugar Steve Mandel, and Unpaid Bill Sherman. The executive producers are Amir Questlove Thompson, Sean G, and Brian Calhoun. Produced by Brittany Benjamin, Cousin Jake Payne, and Laia St. Clair. Edited by Alex Conroy. Produced by iHeart by Noel Brown and Mike Johns.
This episode was engineered by Trevor Young.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.